Getting up this early takes me back to my high school days when I had a morning paper route. I have been identified with agriculture, as you say, but I have never been a get-up-early-and-go-to-work farmer. I'm a front porch rancher. My son Jack's the working member of our family. But I was complimented, even though it's a very early hour, and I'm sure I won't wake up for hours yet, when I walked in and one of the guests said, "Hey, there's Art Linkletter." And I said, "Hello." And he says, "You look better alive than you do on television." Oh, boy. Yesterday I was in Philadelphia talking, and some lady came up to me in the lobby of the hotel. You know, I've been on the air for 37 years. I've been off the air now for about 4 months to show you how fleeting fame is. Lady came up to me in the lobby of the Bellevue Hotel there in Philadelphia and said, "Didn't you used to be Art Linkletter?" How do you like that? Well, I feel at home with a great many of you because of my great interest in agriculture and ranching and farming. As some of you know, some 16 years ago, I became a real dyed-in-the-wool pioneer in Australia. I wrote a book about it called Down Under with Linkletter, in which I related my early adventures in the northern end, the top end, as we call it, of Australia, where I went to make a quick, easy fortune growing rice in the rich delta, Darwin, without realizing that we had unerringly picked the nesting grounds of the world's greatest migratory bird population. And when the word got out around the world that Americans had opened a free cafeteria, you can imagine what happened to our rice. And then after we had somewhat successfully fended off 800 million ducks and geese and other animals that eat anything green, we discovered that there were probably 70,000 wild water buffalo living within 100 miles of our place who could smell any green thing that grew up. Downwind or upwind, 60 or 80 miles. We got our water, of course, in the Adelaide River. It was a very easy thing, with one little exception. There were 25-foot-long seagoing crocodiles in the river. We had 65 inches of rain from December 15th to March 1st, and not a drop afterward. And sometimes the 65 inches of rain came down 20 inches in 2 days. So you can imagine what happened to that end of my agricultural experience. So I went as far away from Darwin as I could possibly get, which was the southwest end of Australia near Perth. And there I became a pioneer in growing pasture and land that had never before grown anything, because we found through Dr. Love of the University of California and others that there were trace elements that made all the difference in the world. Zinc, copper, superphosphate. And we had a 26-inch rainfall spread over 8 months of the year, never a drought in 60 years. And so there we settled, and there I grew my gigantic and beautiful merino sheep. I finally got up to 40,000 head of the finest sheep that you could find in Australia. And then, of course, the international wool market vanished. You guys are in a lousy racket, I want to tell you. Couldn't you have gotten into something like shooting pool or something? Fortunately, we happen to have a couple of million-acre properties in the middle western part of Australia where we grow cattle, and we've had a fine time with that particular business. It's getting better all the time. Then my son Jack got interested in the agriculture and the ranching business, and as some of you know, has been very, very active in promoting and running the International Cattlemen's Exposition in Las Vegas for the last couple of years. And he and I own and operate and run a half a dozen ranches all over the West in some 6 or 7 states. And we are very deeply, deeply interested in the business of agriculture and animal husbandry. He and I serve as vice presidents of the 4-H clubs in the West. And he is also on the Australian Meat Board. So we actually are very, very interested in this business. My interest in veterinarian-type activities also includes my interviews with children, believe it or not. Seems like a rather strange thing to say. I'm not implying that children are animals, which, of course, they are, but any of you who've grown any know You remember what Mark Twain said. He said, when the average child reaches 13, he should be put in a barrel and fed through a bunghole. Until he is 16, when the bunghole should be stopped up. But the reason I alluded to children and animals is that, as many of you know, for 25 years I've been talking to kids. And while most of them are very willing to talk to me, very open, in fact, so open and honest about their own knowledge of their own family that probably my interviews have caused more people to move away and relocate under another name than anything since the Oklahoma land rush. Nevertheless, from time to time I do run into shy, recalcitrant, or withdrawn children. And I have a pet question which I have evolved over the years of experimental work with kids, and that has to do with animals. If a kid won't talk about anything else, his parents, what he wants to be, what he thinks about things, when you talk about animals, a kid opens up, because all kids want to have pets or have had pets. And even the shyest child who has had a pet wants to talk about them. And I have one hot question that always amazes me, because it brings out probably the highest batting average of outrageous answers of any question I've ever run across in these 27 years, 25 years. That question is, you have a pet? Yes. Does it have a pedigree? Now, you know the word pedigree is a word that sounds so familiar that these six-year-olds assume they know what it is, but they don't really. And they say, yes, always do. And I say, your dog has a pedigree? And the kid says, yes. He had six of them last year. Or a little girl says, no, our cat does not have a pedigree. We use powder. Another little boy says, no, our dog doesn't have a pedigree. We're Jewish. Another kid says, we don't think he has a pedigree. We tried it with the dog next door for almost a month. Another one said, he had a pedigree, but we had it cut off. Yes, I've had great fun with kids. A whole generation. And the kids we're having so much trouble with these days, with vandalism, runaways, suicide, drugs, venereal disease, all of the things that are plaguing the kids of today. These are my kids that have grown up. These are kids of the electric generation. They're the first full generation that have grown up watching the television tube all their lives. They all know me. A great many of them have been interviewed by me, and all of them have certainly spent anywhere in their lives from 12 to 20,000 hours in front of the television tube. So we're friends. And that's one reason why I feel so concerned and so motivated to speak and write and talk and study and learn about the problems that are affecting our youngsters today. Because while I am here to talk about the drug problem, I want it very clearly understood that I do not consider the drug problem inherently the only problem. I think it's part of the tip of the iceberg. Drugs are just one dramatic and deadly manifestation of a malaise which is affecting our best young people. It includes many of these other things. The highest suicide rate in the history of Western civilization. The highest runaway rate in the history of Western civilization. More vandalism, more disregard for law. We have a venereal disease epidemic running in this country, the likes of which we have never seen in our history. In the West Coast here in California, of every graduating student in high school, it is estimated that one out of every four have had a venereal disease right now. It is part of a troubled generation. And I want to talk to you about it today because these kids are the kids who are going to be running this country. And while still most of our kids are great kids and are not affected by these things I've been talking to you about, a growing percentage is. And how big a percentage, nobody knows. because figures in this field are very elusive, and they're guessed at, and I'm constantly amazed at the glib statistics which are spewed by so-called experts in a field where there is certainly nobody standing up to be counted. You can talk about arrests. You can talk about confiscation of drugs. You can talk about the growing number of youngsters who are either in jail or in halfway houses or in trouble, but it still is only a guess. However, I would say a good calculated guess is that in the high schools and junior high schools today, at least 70% of all the kids will try some kind of a drug. It might be 80%. Of this 70 or 80% who will try some kind of drug, whether it's glue sniffing in the grammar schools, or, as is now the case, even more deadly, the sniffing of various kinds of aerosols and plastics, which are causing an average of 4 deaths a month in the United States now. Whether it's from that kind of immature experimentation through the more common marijuana usage and then the uppers and the downers and LSD and other things, we estimate that 70 to 80% of the youngsters, by the time they get out of high school, will have tried. Of this 70 or 80%, probably 10 or 15% will become regular users. And of that 10 or 15%, perhaps 2 or 3% will become hooked on speed or barbs or on H, heroin, smack. These are, of course, just general estimates. But it's certainly true that there has probably never been a time in the history of the world when more young people of middle and upper class quality are being made dependent on drugs. Drugs have always been around, you know that. Of some 300,000 different plants, there are about 60 which have hallucinogenic properties, and these were discovered by the Aborigines of the world and have been used for thousands of years to help with the anxieties, the pain, the loneliness, the defeat of life. Marijuana has been smoked almost as long as we have any written history. It's been used in religious rituals. It's been tried as anesthetic. It's been used in various forms all over the world, chewed, smoked, eaten, sniffed, everything you can do. And, of course, we all know the story of opium and all of the opiates and how they've spread and practically ruined China at one time. However, the important thing today is that we discover not the have-nots, not the deprived people, but the ones who should have everything to live for are being hooked on all kinds of drugs. And this is the startling and the frightening thing. I'm not going to take a lot of time this morning in describing the growth of this pestilence in this country, but just to very briefly say that it started about 1958 or 1960. It started coincidentally with many of the problems we're having, the civil riots, the Vietnamese War, the rebellion of the young people against the establishment, the worries about the plastic civilization, and the rise of acid rock music. There is no doubt that the greatest heroes of the young people in this world today over the last 10 years have been acid rock musicians who have sung the drug songs, but more importantly, have lived the drug life. As we know, as I have known all along, but as we all know now, because of the confessions, the bitter acrimony, the accusations among the Beatles, who were certainly the outstanding idols of every young person, the Beatles, from almost the beginning, after their first rise to fame, became drug people. They smoked marijuana openly and bragged about it. They dropped acid. They tried other kinds of things. And don't think for a minute that young people have changed in copying their idols' lifestyle. Just as we in my generation had certain idols, these kids have the record idols. And we have the Jefferson Airplane, the Rolling Stone, the Fugs, the Grateful Dead. And now they're beginning to die in many ways, both physically and in popularity, which is a good thing, especially the latter, because I don't wish anybody death, but the Jimi Hendrix, the Joplins, The others have died from overdoses, and many, many more have been ruined by the drug scene. But the important thing to remember is that this is where the spark was lit by the kids who looked up to record idols who lived the drug life. From the other end of the spectrum came the intellectual, you might say, a collegiate approval of Dr. Timothy Leary and his colleagues, who said that LSD was the greatest mind-expanding drug ever discovered by man. It was the answer to who am I and what am I and where am I going. It expanded the inner brain, was a religious experience, and LSD, from its collegiate Harvard University of California approval, drifted down into the high schools and then the junior high schools until LSD became the most terrible drug. The drug that you know killed my daughter in a terrible moment of panic in a flashback, which we now know a great deal about, and which at that time was still a mysterious thing. Flashback, of course, is a recurrence of the original bad trip, which has all of the overtones and the implications and the experiences of going insane, a psychotic trip, and affects different people different ways, and has flashback strength equal to the original experience for as long as 2 years, and sometimes 3 years after the first and only, or God knows how many, experiments with LSD. So LSD swept across the country, and we began to have a full-blown drug epidemic. Now, why was this possible? Just because of music and rock people and just because of Timothy Leary? No, not at all. This spark was dropped in the driest, most ready tinderbox that had ever been set for an epidemic. Because our kids have grown up in the midst of the greatest pill-popping society in the history of the world. There is no doubt that no country and no people have ever been so over-medicated as the people in the United States. Now, this is not to point the finger at anyone, but merely to give the blame where it belongs, and that is to all of us. Families, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, educators. You point at any segment of our society, and it must take some of the blame for this tinderbox of potential drug abuse. Advertising, you name it. Let me give you a couple of figures. I don't like to use figures, but in 1969, 202 million legal prescriptions were filled in this country, given by doctors, for psychoactive drugs. And if you want to make an average of 10 pills, which is modest for a legal prescription, that's 2 billion legal doses of psychoactive drugs. Now, when you add the non-prescription drugs that come over the counter, you know that that's got to be another 4 to 5 billion. And these are also legal. Is that astonishing, the fact that billions and billions and billions of psychoactive drugs, which affect us in many, many strange ways, are taken in the United States every year? Well, an even more amazing fact is that this kind of drug cannot cure anything. All it does is relieve some tensions and, more dangerously, mask other more complex and more difficult problems. 1.5 million hospital admissions a year in the United States from bad reactions to drugs. Yes, Americans are the most over-medicated society that has ever existed. And of course, this didn't happen deliberately. We didn't go into it with the purpose of becoming drugged. It's part of the life that grew up in a super sophisticated, overheated society. We have more headaches, more anxieties of a different class than anybody's ever had before. And we found out some things that did real great job of covering for us. And you know, the average person in this room will take some kind of a psychoactive drug before the day is over. You will either smoke and get nicotine, which, as you know, in smoking, probably kills and debilitates more people than any other drug that has ever been used. Alcohol, which many of you will have a drink or two of, which when used excessively or moderately, abused in other words, will kill the second greatest number of any drug that has ever been discovered anywhere. And then, of course, a number of you will take tranquilizers, or you will take wake-up or go-to-sleep pills, or you will, at the very least, take the mild drug of caffeine, either in Cokes or in coffee or tannic acid and tea. And a great many people, of course, will take drugs to get thin, to just compose themselves, so that our society today is ready and willing and able to fend off any kind of worry with some kind of a chemical. You know, the hippies have a great big button they wear now. They've taken the Dow Chemical Company's slogan and made it into their password: better living through chemistry. They figure, and you and I figure, really, basically, we've been brainwashed by everything to figure that relief from any kind of anxiety in the whole world is only a swallow away. And our kids have taken that literally, and like most kids, they've just gone two or three steps farther. And so we have today, all across the country, kids who are risking their future by using chemical crutches to get past the moments of anxiety and depression, which are normal in everyone's life. When I was the first victim of this tragedy in my own family, was like most Americans. I was ignorant about the drug field. Being the victim of a tragedy does not make you an expert, but it gives you a powerful motivation to find out what it's all about. And in the 2 years that have passed, I have traveled all over this country. I've spoken with every kind of a drug expert. And I now, I suppose, could be labeled an expert on experts. I have been in and out of free clinics, hotlines, neuropsychiatric wards, drug addiction centers, crash pads. I have been in the lowest parts of New York City and Brooklyn in the ghettos, talking to kids hooked on $150 a day habits. I've been in the Haight-Ashbury and the Sunset Strip. I have wept with runaways. I've held the hands of kids freaked out on bad trips. I've been through the whole scene. I am not talking to you now from book learning, from theories. I am talking from gut level. A man who lost a beautiful daughter to this dreadful, terrible thing, and who has seen and heard and participated in equally tragic stories from coast to coast. One of the most difficult parts of my crusade is that my own wounds are being constantly reopened, unwittingly, by bereaved parents and grieving friends of young people who have taken their own lives. And they dump their problems on me because they know I'll understand, and I do. Just recently, I spoke to the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association in Greenbrier, West Virginia. And while I was there, the publisher of Reader's Digest, who was my host, told me that just a few months before, his own son, who was a all East Coast high school fullback from a fine family and a fine background and a marvelous environment, had gotten turned on to acid through a girlfriend. And when his father remonstrated with him with the customary paranoid schizophrenic reaction, which so often happens with any kind of drug, but more particularly with LSD and cocaine, the kid went to his room and dropped some more acid. They didn't know. At 2 o'clock in the morning, his father heard something and turned over in bed, and there was his son standing over him with a butcher knife. He stabbed his father in the face through the forehead. When his father turned over, he stabbed him in the back through the lungs, ran out and got in the family car, rode through the town at 90 to 100 miles an hour until he had a small crash. The police arrested him, and his father was rushed to surgery at 2 o'clock in the morning, and his life barely saved. Now, this man is one of the top publishers of one of the top magazines of the world, has everything that the kid could possibly dream of having in a way of a future, and yet there is a tragedy that is going to continue as long as they live. The boy didn't die, and the father didn't die. But wounds to that family may never, ever, ever be completely healed. These kinds of stories I hear almost every hour on the hour. People call me. The other night, one of the most famous commentators in the United States called me, crying at 3 o'clock in the morning, sobbing on the phone from New York City to ask me what to do because his son had just been arrested as a pusher. One of the richest men in the United States who lives in Los Angeles called me the other day to tell me that the gardener had dug up a cache of drugs in the backyard by their swimming pool, big enough to establish his son as a furnisher for the whole neighborhood for the next 6 months. In small farming towns, where you might think that the rural atmosphere and the relevancy of the kids to the daily chores and the comparative distance from the sophisticated drug centers would give some measure of freedom, I find kids in great trouble. I talk in small towns, Plainview, Texas, Appleton, Wisconsin, North Dakota and South Dakota, as well as the big towns. And this dreadful thing has spread out. And in some places, rurally, it's worse than it is in some parts of the city, because the rural kids, in an attempt to be sophisticated and catch up with their big city cousins, plunge into it without even as much knowledge as their bigger city, more sophisticated so-called city friends have, and get into deeper trouble faster. I've talked to heroin addicts living in towns of 20 and 30,000. You don't even know how it would ever get there. You'd expect to find it in the ghettos of New York or on the Haight, but not there. And yet it's everywhere. Everywhere, and none of us can go to sleep at night without feeling that possibly it's at our doorstep. It's interesting that in the 2 years that I've been talking on this subject, one or two very, very good things have happened. Number one, the American public has become alerted to the problem. And when I started, they refused to accept the fact that it was here. Families will not believe that their beautiful, golden-haired, blue-eyed kid could possibly be hooked on anything. Today, they know it's possible. And the first thing that was necessary to battle this plague was to be aware of it, to acknowledge it. In a recent Roper report, asking what was the major cause of the problems of the United States today, the use of drugs was listed number one by the American people in a vote of 47%. Give you an idea, the Vietnam War was 40%, and racial tensions 33%, and communism 18%. I disagree with this. I do not think that drugs are the major cause of the problems in the United States today. I think it's the scapegoat for social ills, because there's nothing wrong with drugs. What's wrong is with people, any more than there's nothing wrong with guns. A gun by itself lying on a table can't hurt anybody, and a drug in a box or a pill or wherever isn't going to hurt anybody. It's when it's used and how it's used and why it's used and for how long and under what conditions it caused the trouble. And that's the real problem. We are never, ever, 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 in my opinion, going to be able to shut off drugs that are harmful. There are so many ways to bring heroin and cocaine into this country that I could spend the next hour telling you fantastic stories of the way that ingenious and greedy criminals are bringing drugs into this country. They bring them in under the raised dots of Braille books. They bring them in inside of automobile bodies which have been opened and filled with drugs and re-welded and painted. They bring them in balloons, which they swallow an hour before they get to customs, and so on and so forth. We can never stop, in my opinion, the black market labs, the little dirty, miserable chemical laboratories all over this country that manufacture every kind of a dirty drug you can think of. Tainted LSD, fake mescaline. You know, mescaline is now the big in thing among many kids because LSD is considered to be dangerous. Now we know the probable genetic chromosome breakdowns. We know the death and destruction that follows LSD. So the pushers are selling mescaline. And you know what mescaline is most all over the country? 95% LSD. Pushers have no morals, no conscience, no responsibility. They lie, they burn, which is the underworld word for hurting in some way by selling poison in place of the real thing. We'll never be able to stop that. We won't be able to build enough jails to hold either the pushers or the users or the manufacturers. We won't be able to do it with laws. And even though the pharmaceutical companies are now, and the pharmacists and the doctors are now aware that the whole thing has gotten out of hand and are taking measures to stop the rat holes through which drugs escape in shipment, in hijacking, in hospitals. I had a call, give you an example of the kind of call I got about 2 weeks ago. I had a call from a colored man up in San Francisco. He said, "Mr. Linkletter," he says, "I want to talk to you about something very important." He says, "You aren't recording this, are you?" I said, "Well, it would be no use. I don't know who you are." He says, "My wife and I talked to you because we thought you were the only person in the world we could trust." He says, "I work in a hospital." He says, "If anybody knew I was talking to you, I'd get fired." He says, "But there's a nurse here who's selling drugs. She's getting out of the supply room." And he says, "We think it's terrible what she's doing, and something ought to be done. But we can't do anything about it because we don't know who to talk to." Well, I got the details. The woman was later apprehended. These kinds of things are happening, and we're never going to be able to stop that. So what are we going to do? We're going to have to talk about people and people problems and understand why people are turning on to drugs and get them to turn off. And I think the way to start is right down at the first grade. I have a fund called the Diane Linkletter Fund, administered by the School of Medicine of the University of California in San Francisco, which has for its principal purpose the research and the preparation of curricula for the young grammar school student, starting in the first grade. We have discovered that when we start telling our kids early about what drugs are, it takes a great deal of the mystification and the romance and the surreptitious, clandestine game playing with adults out of the drug field. And we do not believe that kids in the first, second, third, and fourth grade should be taught drugs per se, that they should be sat down and lectured about the dangers of drugs. We think it should be infiltrated into the various subjects, whether it's spelling or reading or writing, and it should be both good and bad. In other words, drugs are not a bad thing. Some of them are. Some good drugs are misused. Some good drugs are abused. Some bad drugs are used and should never be used. And we gradually teach our kids, right from the first grade, that drugs are a weapon for good and bad, a double-edged sword. We take them in the fifth and sixth grade, and we demonstrate the power of marijuana on the central nervous system by putting into glass jars marijuana and hashish smoke, where spiders, for instance, are weaving their webs, and the kids are fascinated by living creatures. And they're shown how the spiders, through the genetic chromosomic input, spin the same kind of webs over and over. One kind of spider has a certain pattern, another has another, and this goes on practically through the centuries. And when these spiders are subjected to marijuana and hashish smoke, the kids then see what happens to the webs. These beautiful gossamer, geometric gems become tattered and uneven. They become all cockeyed, which is a marvelous way to show a kid what can happen to a nervous system that goes into drugs. We give young rats and other animals of that kind various kinds of drugs and show what happened to them with their offspring, how they treat them, what happens to family life. These are the ways that you really impress a kid with what drugs can do. And then, of course, as the kids get older, there should be classes and subjects which stress human defense mechanisms against problems of growing up. Our kids have all been sheltered. They've been shielded. They've been given everything, too much, too soon, by a loving, doting generation that worked their tail off in the 30s and the 40s and now want our kids to have everything. And they've gotten everything and they've been shielded from the things that they must get sooner or later, which is pain, discomfort, trouble, defeat, lonesomeness, anguish. We all have to go through that. But the kids today don't understand that. And I think there should be courses in junior high school on the art of living, which point out that every one of us human beings have moments of bewilderment, of frustration. We have times when we're going to be defeated, and that the way to handle that is not through alcohol or any other drug. And those are the kinds of things we must prepare our youngsters for and not shield them. I would say that our family life in America today is one of the major causes for drug abuse, runaways, and all of the other things. I would level the finger at most American families who unwittingly have placed their child way down the list in top priorities. We love our children. We think they have everything. And yet, in a survey made of all the Western so-called civilized developed countries, American children are lower on the list of top priorities by parents than any other group. Dr. Bronfenbrenner of Cornell University says that we give our children money and things. We do not give them ourselves. And the reason is we're all busy. We're busy making money, doing good, having fun, traveling, or watching television. Every once in a while, some mother comes up to me after a lecture and she says, well, our family is having a load of trouble and yet we're home four nights a week. So don't give me this baloney about our family being all split up. I said, what are you doing at home? She was watching television. I said, you ever talk to each other? Yeah, we talk, you know, between commercials and shows. Very little communication. I mean communication, two-way communication between mothers and dads and kids these days. There are lectures, or there are flare-ups by the kids, but the American family has become isolated in its own little pursuit of pleasure or money or career or whatever. Over and over again, you know, you read about people who have deep trouble in their families and they're the leaders in every kind of do-good activity in the town, which is another thing that can happen, you know. You can be so busy saving the world, you forget to look into your own nest. But at all events, our kids today have a very low list on personal priority, and that's got to change. Because if the kids don't feel relevant, if there isn't an interpersonal relationship between mother and daughter and son and father, you find that drug addiction is likely to happen. Dr. Louis Luria, about 5 days ago, incidentally, came out with the fact that in a survey of families where there are drug problems or non-drug problems, he found a distinct correlation between the kind of family life, the kind of pill using, the kind of presence at home of fathers and the rest of it, definitely connected with usage by children. In that connection, in talking to the National Association of Manufacturers at the Waldorf about 3 months ago, I said that big business has its share of responsibility in this fabric of our society, of family and homemaking, in that too often big business shuttles people around like pins on a map without any regard for how often the husband is home or whether the family has moved every 2 or 3 years. And business has to think about the terms of a family unit and its happiness and its ability to have a head of the house there. You see, ladies and gentlemen, when you look at our American family today, which we're so proud in this great country of ours, we see really a pretty shabby creature. We see one out of every three families split by divorce, which is a tremendous figure. We see one out of every five families moving every year, which means that there's a whole new set of challenges, rootlessness, change, all the things that upset families. You see a third of the mothers working, and 50% of the working mothers, of that third, have children in grammar schools. So you see kids coming home, latchkey children, children coming home where there are no parents waiting for them. Then you see, of course, in our civilization, a denigration a downgrading of the father. Dad's supposed to be a kind of a funny jerk in all the sketches and the comic strips and television plays. And when he's not supposed to be a kind of a ridiculous buffoon, at the very least, he's supposed to be a guy trying to be a pal to his kid. More families lose discipline and respect and authority by being pals than almost anything I can think of. I don't think children need pals. They need parents. And I think that the home where the parent, in some cases, is even smoking marijuana over and over and over again, we see this, with the kids to show them that they're part of the generation, present generation, there's no generation gap. And they smoke marijuana with the kids or pop pills with the kids to be a part of the gang. Kids don't want pals. They want parents, really. And they need fences, and they need discipline. They need love, and they need care, and they need communication. And this is a deep, deep, deep problem, and I realize that it's going to be difficult to change because our civilization is pell-mell, full speed out, in a pressure cooker kind of a life, and it's hard to change that. You know, the whole drug business, in a way, is like an intersection at a street. It's a dangerous intersection, and cars are crashing into each other, and we're killing each other and maiming each other at a street corner. That would be like the drug abuse problem. And so what do we do at that street corner? Well, there are a couple of things we can do. We can put up signs. Stop. Warning. Slow. Look out. Careful. Caution. We can start driver education courses on how to approach intersections, how to drive, how to put out your hand, what to do. We can hire policemen to stand at the corner and arrest lawbreakers and stop people from doing wrong. And we can have ambulances and hearses standing by to haul away the wounded and the dead from that intersection. All those things we can do. We can build the cars stronger. How much better it would be to build an overpass where the cars couldn't meet, where there couldn't be crashes. In effect, this is a parallel in a long way to the drug problem. We are doing all these things. We're building jails and passing laws and hiring policemen and taking care of hospitals and halfway houses and synanons and rehabilitation centers. But we aren't changing the intersection. And of course, the intersection I'm talking about is the American family, the American religious institution, the American educational institution. And those are the gut level, real inside, bottom line answers to this drug problem. Families have got to get closer and love and care and know. Parents have got to know about drugs. They've got to stop being hysterical and reacting emotionally and got to learn that you can't say marijuana is a narcotic because every kid will start laughing at you because he knows marijuana is not a narcotic. You can't start overdrawing and mysticizing drugs because they know better. On the other hand, you can't afford to just let it all go and think it's a fad and it's going to pass by. Parents have to learn, have to be concerned. Doctors have to learn a little more about pharmacology. Doctors have to be more responsible in prescribing drugs for every damn thing in the world. Pharmaceutical companies, in the pursuit of the buck, have to stop advertising and selling good drugs for purposes they weren't intended for. And I don't mean to point my finger at the pharmaceutical houses as being any different than any other business in the United States. General Motors is trying to sell more cars. Pillsbury is trying to sell more cake mix. Pharmaceuticals are trying to sell more drugs. That's their business. But when a pharmaceutical company selling Ritalin, for instance, will advertise, as I have seen, for this tranquilizer drug to be used on school children who are disciplinary problems, or on college students who are going away from home and who will be lonesome and anxious because their first trip away from home, or in convalescent homes where older people are querulous and unhappy. When you start spreading a drug which is a good drug for minimal dysfunction of the brain, and perhaps medically should be used in about 0.5% of these kind of cases, and you begin to spread the wonderful, soothing properties of this drug out over all kinds of emotional and disciplinary and human frailties, then the drug business has got to take a long look at itself and say, wait a minute, we have added responsibilities besides the buck to our stockholders. Educators have got to stop saying, it's not our problem, it's a family problem. In school, we're teaching reading, writing, arithmetic. Their morals, their character, what they do and how they live is not our problem. They've got to change that because it is their problem. The character of our kids, in many cases, is as important or more important than their brains. Ministers have to get out of the pulpit and get among the people. This is already being evidenced by the fact that the kids have turned off religion formally and now are turning on to religion in the streets. You've heard about the street Christians, the Jesus freaks, the Christian revolutionaries, on and on and on. These kids who are druggers have a high moral tone to their conversation. I've talked to hundreds of druggers, and invariably, down the line, will come their disillusionment with life, their high hopes for an idealistic society, but they hope to find it in drugs, and they're disappointed because it isn't there. Drugs are nothing but a mirage, and so they're turning to Christianity. And incidentally, I want to say just in passing that of all the things that I have seen which are an answer to drug abuse and real drug misuse, I'm talking about needle freaks, hypes, religion, has been the most effective, the most miraculous, the most sustaining, and the most permanent kind of cure I have ever seen anywhere. I have seen miracles, miracles. $150 a day habits kicked cold turkey without physical distress when a kid has given his life to Jesus. I've seen miracles happen. But it's because the kids want something that they aren't finding in this life. They aren't finding it in their families. They aren't finding it in their church. They're not finding it in their schools. And so they're turning to all kinds of kooky things. One of them is drugs. And so, as we look around, we see that there is hope. We must not give up, but we must take a long look in the mirror. Sometimes when I talk to parents and teachers, especially parents, I say to them, I wonder how many of you would take up this challenge. How many of you would go home to your 13, 14, 15-year-old kid and say, if you will never take a drug, I will never take a drink? Not very many, because none of us want to deprive ourselves of that belt or two that's kind of fun or that pack of cigarettes that's hooked us. And yet we expect our kids to. We have a double morality. You know that, don't you? A double morality. Just as plain as the nose on your face, we have one set of morals for grown-ups and one set of morals for kids. We tell them not to do the things they see us doing. How are you going to tell a kid who sees his dad get smashed every Saturday night, or his mother high on amphetamines in the afternoon when he comes home, or groggy from barbiturates in the morning when she still wakes up from a heavy sedative, how are you going to tell them not to try drugs? Out of the world. Out of the question. They're going to use them. They see them all around them. We have a double set of standards. We're keeping our kids in school way beyond what kids were ever kept before. We're calling them children when they're still 18 or 19. They're not relevant anymore. They're not needed anymore. They're not a part of society. Is there any doubt that they're going to look for something from boredom and monotony and irrelevancy? Drugs? And incidentally, booze is still the number one problem in college. You can hear all about drugs, but booze, alcohol, is still the number one. And it's the number one problem in drugs in the United States. Absolutely no question about that. I'm going to finish in just a couple of moments. I am now, as was indicated in the introduction, the president of the National Coordinating Council on Drug Education. I work in Washington, D.C. with Dr. Jaffe, the new head of the President's Special Office on Drugs. I'm speaking on September 14th to the United Nations as a citizen, as a bereaved parent, as a human being, not as a government official, not as a bureaucratic member of some rule-setting society. I'm going to talk to the drug-producing and drug-exporting countries of this world and to their officials as a human being who pleads with them for the sake of humanity, to do something which they are not doing because of economics, national needs, and other things. I am going to spend the next few years writing and speaking about this subject because I think we are beginning to make inroads. I view the drug epidemic like a forest fire that has begun without us really being aware of it happening. A forest fire to which we have everyone contributed some piece of tinder, whether it's family, profession, business, advertising, what have you. And all of a sudden, we have discovered a conflagration that is so big that, like a forest fire, it creates its own firestorm. And I think for many of the kids who are hooked on drugs, it is too late, at least to ever get them back to normal. We are losing many kids permanently. I see kids on acid and speed, with speed runs, who are absolutely down the drain as far as their brains are concerned. The chances of them ever coming back are gone. But we've got millions who aren't hooked. Millions and millions and millions. And those are the ones we've got to save. And the way we're saving them is by setting backfires ahead of this forest fire. And the backfires are education, modernization of legal laws that will treat our kids as sick, not as criminals, as professional knowledge, as doctors and pharmacologists rally around to the cause, as all of the many religious institutions begin to gird their loins, as the straight institutions like the Future Farmers of America, 4-H, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, YMCAs, rally around and start preaching SOS, stamp out stupidity, because it is stupid. These things are happening, and I think these backfires are going to be where we're going to lick this forest fire of drug abuse. And I hope that as you go back to your homes and your colleges and your parts of the country, you will take this thought with you, that each one of us must do his part, no matter how little or how big. And the first thing that you must do is to really find out what drugs are all about. There are many books available. There are many good films now available. There is no excuse for any human being in the United States to be ignorant on the subject of drugs, and yet we all have been. That's number one. Number two, as parents, you must take a long look at your own family. Going through some of the requisites for a good family that I have mentioned. As professors and teachers, you must be a little island of character building in your own classes and among your own colleagues, because today in colleges and high schools we are finding an ever-growing number of young college professors and teachers using marijuana and uppers and downers as a lifestyle that's considered smart and in. As members of civic clubs, you could do something about the educational content of your own city and state schools insofar as drugs are concerned. And certainly, as people in the business that have to do with tranquilizers and other chemicals, you can be careful about their use. You know, they're even using animal tranquilizers now. They're spraying it on marijuana. They call it fairy dust when it dries. And you can imagine what it does to kids. Professionally, but more importantly, as human beings, you can be a part of this battle. No one of us is going to win it. And I don't think we're ever going to win it, because human beings want to have chemical crutches. They always have and they always will. But somehow down the line, we're going to stem the epidemic proportions of this terrible thing that's happened to us. We're going to get back to a realization that the greatest turn on in life is life itself. And if today's talk has even saved the anguish of one parent in this room, it's been well worth my time and my effort. And I thank Eli Lilly for bringing me here, and I've enjoyed meeting some people whom I respect and admire. Thank you.